Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see?
Good evening. This is the Progressive News Network. My name is Mickey Royce. I'm the co-producer of SAME. Our fearless news lead director, Rick Spezak, is on assignment and will be back next weekend. So tonight we have a couple of interviews that he conducted earlier, thinking of everyone in advance. So why don't we get right to it, okay? This is a representative for the National Organization for Women in Palm Beach County.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome the president of Now Palm Beach, Ms. Meredith Ockman. Welcome, Meredith.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Rick.
It's our pleasure. You know, the folks here at PNN are longtime human rights supporters, and it seems that for some people it's very difficult to appreciate the fact that all humans, you know, deserve human rights. And you've got a wonderful event coming up in salute of people who are working hard for human rights. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yes. Well, Palm Beach County National Organization for Women is celebrating the 40th annual Susan B. Anthony Feminist of the Year Award Luncheon. So we get the opportunity each year to celebrate somebody in our community who has been extraordinary in multiple areas of the work that we do, and it gives us an opportunity to recognize that person. And the list is phenomenal of people who have gotten everything from Susan Booker to Ann Gannon, Lois Frankel, Mona Reese, Lillian Tamayo. I mean, just people who from all different walks of life, women from all over the community have been recognized in this event each year. And this is our big bash. It's the 40th annual.
Oh, that's fantastic. Obviously, you can't reveal who it is.
No, I can.
Oh, you can? Oh, well, fantastic.
Definitely. We advertise it, absolutely. I mean, we want to make sure that people have the opportunity to congratulate her. Dr. Jane Caputi from Florida Atlantic University, she's been a professor there working in the Women and Gender Studies program for a long time, and she's just since it's been open, and she's an author, and she's done research, and she's just completely amazing. If you have the opportunity to talk to this woman, she will enlighten you every time you come in contact with her. So it's always a pleasure to see her, and they always have their Women's Equality Day event that we co-sponsor each year, and that's in part because of her efforts.
Well, that's great. So when and where is this marvelous salute to the good doctor going to be?
The event is going to be on Sunday, February 10th. It starts at noon, but the doors open between 11 and 11:30. We're going to let people start coming in. We recommend that people get there early. For some organizations, they'll be getting tables, but otherwise the seating is an open seating, so people get the opportunity to meet new people.
Little networking.
The cool thing is, because this is the 40th anniversary of the event, partially because this is my last big event as the president of Palm Beach County National Organization for Women, because I'm not running for re-election in April, we have this incredible opportunity that they've given us to give out what we're calling special honors awards as well. So for each of our priority issues, we're going to be recognizing somebody who's made a difference in that category. I don't know if we have enough time for me to reveal who those people are as well.
Why don't you give us at least a couple?
Okay. I'll read them off, and if you can work on that, then it's for reproductive health, Debbie Katz. And mind you, we haven't told a couple of people about their award just yet, so we're still working on that. But
okay.
for Economic Justice, Lisa Tilson, for Gender Equality, Representative Lori Berman, for LGBT Rights, we're Nicole Leidendorf, she's a former CEO of Compass, for Diversity, Marcia Hayden, who's the president of the ACLU, Palm Beach County, for Violence Against Women, Julie Weil, who had testified in front of Congress and who's done some work on the VAWA Act, and for Moving the Next Generation Forward, Mindy Fetterman, who has been a Palm Beach County Now member since for ages, and she's just recently started the new chapter of Now in Port St. Lucie in the Treasure Coast. So just an amazing, amazing list of people, and then we get to see everybody in one room. It's going to be so much fun. Just a huge...
That's a lot of people power, boy, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's going to be wonderful.
Well, listen, as we face this... this new year of 2013, and we just had the good fortune to see our Secretary of State stand up to, let's just say, at best, a little impolite questioning in Congress. What do you see in the year ahead as the important issues for human rights, especially women's rights?
Well, our priority issues span everyone's rights. I think we're going to see, I'm hoping to see some better leadership on immigrant rights in the upcoming year. I'm hoping to see some better leadership in LGBT rights, even though we've done so much and come so far, there's still a lot of work to do there. So those are the two priority issues, and the ERA seems like it's moving very quickly. You know, since we've seen the combat piece taken out of the conversation about the ERA now, because Secretary Panetta has now lifted the ban on women in combat, I hope to see that moves forward. And of course, the Violence Against Women Act, that has never been a controversial act, has been bringing us some challenges, and I think that's gonna go ahead through as well.
Well, let's hope that, I'm going to be impolite. I hope the Republicans get a clue.
Well, you know, listen, here's the problem. I think it's not all Republicans. And you know, I echo something that Gloria Steinem said
sure.
when she was talking about this too. The problem is most Republicans, most people in general recognize human rights. Unfortunately, those are not some of the people with the microphone. So what we need to do is a better job of getting the people who are conscious of what the real issues are, getting that moving forward and making sure that those people are the ones who are the voices for that party and not, you know, not people who have their heads in the sand about human rights. These are, you know, it's basic human rights that we want for everyone. And there's a very small percentage of people with the microphone who are speaking out against it.
Well, you know, this world has seen that spectacle of the terrible story in India, and unfortunately the reality is that's not isolated to any one country. Unfortunately, terrible behavior like that is all too common. We've seen the progress just recently on women's access to a variety of new positions in the military, but let's hope that there's equal and if not greater progress on treating women responsibly and treating all soldiers responsibly.
I think that this past election has shown us, I mean, has blatantly demonstrated the fact that people are on our side. People want human rights. And the more we talk about it, and the more I see public addresses from the President of the United States talking about the LGBT rights and women's rights and the rights of immigrants, and, you know, he understands and they understand what needs to be done. And now that we have 20 women in the Senate, that's 20 more voices that, you know, that we can move forward with in this election. You know, I'm very optimistic about the future. You know, I think we're going to see a lot of really coming out of that.
Well, let me be among the many, I'm sure, who are congratulating you on a wonderful tour as president, and I wish you the greatest things ahead.
Thank you so much, Rick, and thank you always for having me. You're such a great friend to Now and to me, and I really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks again. Give them that date one more time.
It's going to be February 10th, starting at noon, and it's going to be at the Boca Club, at 17751 Boca Club Boulevard at the Boca Country Club. And if anyone wants information, they can go to www.tbcnow, like Palm Beach County Now.
Thanks so much, Meredith, and best luck. We'll see you there.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, that takes care of that. Mark your calendar. And Rick and I have attended that event in the past, and it is a lot of fun. And the food wasn't bad either. So, okay, so now we have an interview with Lee Tiger, a very interesting person. He's a musician. He is a proud member of, I'm not going to pronounce this right, Mikasani tribe. In any case, take a listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Lee Tiger, a performing artist, communicator, lecturer, and a public relations specialist. Mr. Tiger, welcome, sir.
Hey, it's good to be here. I like to say hello to all your listeners, and I hope people learn something, and I hope I can share some good stuff with them.
Well, Mr. Tiger, I have known you, fortunately, for many, many years. Way back, I met you first in the 80s and had a chance to do some performing arts work with you. I know the band that you had, Tiger Tiger, is fantastic. A very eclectic group that does everything from hard rock classics to original music. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself, sir, about your musical career?
Okay, well, that started when I was very young. Myself and my brother, we found years ago, before the tribe even had Christmases, because, you know, Mississippi, we come from, you know, many, many years ago, and we didn't know about Christmas till the non-Indian introduced it. So it was a good friend of my father, Buffalo Tiger, my dad, and his friend Bob Mitchell in Orlando said, "Hey, Mr. Tiger, why don't we could do some help up here in Orlando." So they set up a Toys for Tot kind of a Christmas run, and they got about 2 truckloads every year and brought it down for Christmas, for our first Christmases back in, must have been the 60s, early 60s, maybe late, yeah, early 60s, when we had our first Christmases at my, with Jimmy Tiger's Miccosukee Indian Village, which it was a large village back then, and that's where we had our first Christmases. And my brother and myself found 2 plastic guitars that you could actually tune.
Wow.
Right about when we were 12 years old, we said, we started hearing our cousins play music. They had really good guitars, like Gibson guitars, and they were in their Chickies at old Muse Island Indian Village down in Miami many years ago, and they'd be playing their guitars at night, and we'd say, wow, we'd like to do that. So we got our plastic guitars and tried to mimic them, and we actually started learning how to play songs like Wipeout or Party songs or Adventurous songs and all. So we got started, and we had our neighbors down the street. They're Latin guys, and they had a band. So we used to go down and watch them, and we said, wow, that's for us. We were like 13, so, something like that. And then so one thing led to another, and we got into having real guitars and put they were acoustic, and then we put electric pickups on
right.
the guitars and went electric.
Cool.
At the time I was 14, my brother had left and gone to school out in Oklahoma. I stayed back, and I started playing with some of my school buddies. And we started playing at sock hops, you know, at the basketball games, and then roller rinks, and just little teenage nightclub kind of things back then. And one thing led to another. I just really got into it heavily. I just was in my room every day after school. After I did my homework, I would be strumming on that guitar just as long. I mean, I just couldn't stop. I was just so attached to it. And my brother later came back, and so we talked about, I had one of the fellows in my school, his name was Tommy Higgs. He's passed now, but Tommy Higgs was in my school, and we got together, and I told him, I said, look, when my brother gets back, you play drums, I play lead guitar, my brother plays rhythm, let's put together a band. He said, yeah. So I talked to my brother, wrote him, and he said, that sounds good, because he'd also been playing up in some Indian school in Sequoia, I think it was, in Oklahoma. That's where he was going to school at. So he was also playing guitar by that time, and we all got together when he got back, and we called ourselves the Renegades. Years and years. We were playing around, and we got managed by Tommy Hicks's neighbor, who was a sergeant on Miami Beach. And but he was a good manager. He got us gigs everywhere, Key West and up in Fort Lauderdale, and that was a long ways back then. You know?
Sure. Well, you started gigging really young then.
Yeah, we were little kids. And so that happened, and we got really more involved in it as we got into the age of 15. We started playing with bigger bands, alongside bigger bands, and we were playing at a place called the Cheetah,
mm-hmm.
in Miami, Cheetah Nightclub. It was just a nightclub, not the ones you see.
Sure.
The street corners now. It was a teenage nightclub called the Cheetah, and there was a band that was a home band. They were from New York, and they were incredible. They just knocked everybody out with their great vocals and they had keyboard. They had a Hammond B3, which nobody used back then.
We used
little keyboard or
Rhodes yeah. pianos.
That we didn't have those then. We didn't, in fact, we didn't use much of that at all. We just used guitars mainly. One thing led to another, and the band guitar player had appendicitis, so he couldn't play, and so they asked me to sit in. So I sat in with them, and they liked me. I said, hey, we want you to stay with us. Now, they were a professional band owned by a management company out of New York. So I joined them, and my brother said, hey, you got to do it. I said, you know, I'm going to feel bad. We got to break this up right now. He says, no, go ahead. This is for your future, it's better for you, and we'll probably get back together anyway, which was what happened. I stayed with them about a year and a half. They later turned into a group that was pretty well known called NRBQ.
Sure.
Yeah, that was the group, seven of us, that originally, in fact, I helped put together some of that group when it was seven of us, Terry Adams, and I had found him and got him, brought him in. And I played with them, and then later we came apart about a year and a half later, and I brought the bass player, Joey, back with me from New York, and we started up a group called The Bangs, and played at this place called The World over in Miami. Big place.
Oh, yeah.
We played with some big headliners from Spirit to The Rascals to Hokel Harum and Wayne Cochran.
Sure.
Headliners back then. And, So we were like another head band. Seven of us were like way up there. So we did quite well with them. And so did the Bangs. We did quite well with that.
And you played that first Miami Pop Festival.
Yes, we did. Now, what happened then was we the Bangs had split apart, and we started a new band called the Sun Country, or Sun Country. And do you remember Norman Harris?
Sure.
Okay, Norman Harris now has Norm's Rare Guitars out in L.A., Ventura. In fact, I go see him every year, and I Midnight Mission with Richie Zambora and all those guys. Some of the guys.
Yeah.
Oh, we just hang out and compare notes, but it's a good cause, so that's what we do. So we started doing major concerts with the Sun Country. We were at the Image playing, and this guy came up and said, we're from New York. My son has a company called ESP Discs, ESP Discs. And ESP Disc had artists like avant-garde artists like Sun Ra and the Fugs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Completely wild troops. But they wanted a Native American group, so they picked us up. We went up to New York, and we recorded in the Catskills. It was a beautiful time. I mean, that was 1968, 69. It was such a beautiful time. So we did a really nice album, kind of live. It was in the meadow between two mountains, and we did some overdubbing, but it was more or less kind of live with two mics out in the field, so out in the mountain, I mean. And it was a beautiful time, and we ended up, it never came out in America. It later came out and with Sony, ZYX, over in Germany, and so we went on and we moved over to California, did the California thing and had managers out there and did the Whiskey A Go-Go and the Troubadour, the Corral, and a Bag of Nails Club and a few other places. And we stayed out there about a year, and my father said, hey, Lee, why don't you come on back and help me? By then, the tribe had only been recognized for less than 10 years. And so he needed help with public relations. And I thought, well, shoot, you know, I don't know anything about public relations or speaking to people and offices and all that stuff. It's way above me, you know, as I thought then. I'm a musician. I know how to play guitars, and I know how to make people happy by playing guitars. But I don't know anything about the business of public relations and marketing. And so he said, well, what are you guys doing? I said, we're playing music. He says, well, come back here and play music, and then you'll invite people out, and we'll have festivals out here. More people will come out and learn about Mikitsuki, and that's what we need. That's what I want guys to do. So I talked to my brother, and I said, man, he's right. This would be good for us to do. So we came back, and we started Tiger Tiger when we came back.
Sure, sure.
And Tiger Tiger. And we started playing all around South Florida. We started doing these festivals. We also recorded four little records, 45s?
Yeah, yeah.
45 records. In fact, I'll never forget that because we were in Studio B at RCA Studios, Nashville. And the A&R guy was a good friend of my father's. And he had Elvis Presley in Studio A the same time when we were recording. So he says, you want to meet Elvis? And my brother says, nah, I don't. So I said, yeah, I'd like to meet him. So he took me over to him, and they let me go in the studio. Then he introduced me to Elvis. And so I said, you know, we're here recording some Native American type rock and roll. He says, that's cool. He says, I'm part Indian or something like that. But I knew he was, but first time I ever heard anybody say that, especially him. And so we finished our little records there. In fact, that's how we got the name. The engineer was asking us what to put on the disc or on the tapes. What's your name? Well, my name's Lee Tiger. My brother's Steve Tiger. And he says, well, I know your daddy. I know your granddad's name is Tiger Tiger. He says, your names are Tiger, Tiger, and Tiger. So why don't you just call it Tiger, Tiger on the box here? And if you want, you can change it later. So we left it as that. And we continued that. It was 1974. We continued on as Tiger, Tiger. And with our little 45s, and then moving, doing shows all over, TV shows, radio shows. It really caught on. We were something different. We were Native American guys. We're musicians. Our musicians that happen to be Native American. And one thing led to another, and we started these festivals that went over big time, and we started getting thousands of people to come out to our events and our festivals, which was good for recognition of the Mikitsuki tribe, like I said, even back then, because the tribe was only recognized in 1962. And I'll go into a little bit of that. It's a good time to go into that. The tribe was recognized in 62. Before that, we were just fragments of families that escaped Andrew Jackson's deportation. And Andrew Jackson, in the 1800s, signed some kind of bill or whatever, the declaration of war to go to war against it was Creek families that were in Southeast, located in what now is known as Southeast United States. We were in what was now known as Tallahassee, and we lived around the lake. There's a lake over there called Lake Mikitsuki. Miko is top, Sugi is hog. So that was what we were called, top hog keepers. We weren't cattlemen, but we had a lot of pigs, so we never went without bacon or ham. And then deer, meat and fish and all that. But we lived peacefully up there for centuries, as far as I know. And then came this war. It was called the Seminole Wars. Why it was called that, I have no idea. But after the years, I started realizing, and after talking to people historians and just other people from the street that actually knew a lot of just information from that was been handed on to them Miccosukees as well as non-Indian people that were aware of some of the things and that went on. And so
in your lecture you explain where the name Seminole came from.
Yes, that's what I was going to get to. The word, the reason I had a problem with the word Seminole Wars, because I knew that Seminole was not a Miccosukee or Hidjetit, that's our dialect, it's Hidjetit word. And so I later found out it's a Spanish word that meant wild people or people wild, something to that effect. And so I thought, well, we're not wild. The families of Miccosukee and the Hidjetit and Muscogee Creeks are the main tribe. We're federations of the Creek Nation. The Creek occupied Southeast United States before it was called the United States. And so our people were peaceful. So I said, I don't understand why we want to go to war. So later I learned that the word Seminole was the non-Indians trying to say Chimarrones, and it ended up being Seminole. So, where did the name come from, or how did anybody get the name Wild People or Chimarrones from the Spaniards? And my theory is this, and other people have also the same theory, that during that time that the Spanish were in Florida, there's people that, and I tend to believe that too, that like any culture, there was some, I believe there's some Spaniards that like to party and drink and just goof off. Maybe they didn't work, and so they probably took money, and I understood they were wild people. I mean, they just kind of whatever they took when they wanted, and there was a lifestyle, and maybe some Miccosukee or maybe some Creek guys hooked up with them and say, hey, I like that lifestyle too. That's fun. old-fashioned bikers or something. but the name carried on when Andrew Jackson decided to go to war against the Creek families. Peaceful family, but they wanted them out of Southeast United States. And I think it was also because the Indian families, or the Miccosukees and the Creek families, used to take in plantation owners, slaves, folks that would run away from the plantations and come to the tribe, and the tribe would put, so we'll take you, but you got to share your corn or whatever food, and we'll give you the land, and we'll protect you. So I think the government didn't like that. Maybe the plantation owners, so they went against and said, got to Andrew Jackson. Maybe that's how it went. I'm not really sure, but I have a funny feeling that's maybe how it went, and that's why they wanted the Indians out of Florida, Southeast United States. So there was three wars in the early 1800s, one in the 50s, and then I think they ended around 70 in 1870s. Those three wars were called Seminole Wars. I think they were one of the most costliest, and I hear one of the most embarrassing wars, because they were sending soldiers out into the Everglades on horseback, which you can't pick one. And these guys must have had a hard time, these soldiers, because it's just really rough out there. If you don't know how to deal with the Everglades, it could be treacherous, alligators and snakes and just all kinds of creatures that you don't know about, that if you don't know about them, know how to deal with them, it's rather hard to do. So they ended up stopping the wars, and we existed, kept on existing peacefully after the wars. The families settled into two different areas. Lake Okeechobee, where a lot of near water and all that, around Lake Okeechobee, Hollywood, Florida, and then down into the Florida Everglades around the Tamiami Trail, around in that area, all down south into the lower part of Florida, tip in. And we set up on out there in the Everglades. We set up on hammocks, on the hammocks, islands in the river grass, and we set up chickies. We had to change our homes from the log cabins that we used to live in Tallahassee because it's cold up there. We had to change it to adapt to the tiki style home, which we call chicky, C-H-I-C-K-E-E, which means house in Mississippi. And it's in a hammock. It could be like four or five, maybe six chickies, where the cook chicky, an eating chicky, like a dining room, and then other chickies that are like rooms for sleeping and working. They're all raised up on platforms, so if the water got high or alligators running around or snakes. So that's the way it was. And when I was a little kid, I remember Jimmy Tiger's Indian Village, because I grew up there, and I remember in way back into maybe the 1956, 57, 58 of being out there. There was no bathrooms. They had just outhouses and no electricity. My uncle finally got a generator. No TVs. You didn't even see TV at all. Nothing. And no computers, of course.
Yep.
And,
yep.
But it was a good life. I used to fish a lot and help my dad with arts and crafts and all like that. But it was a good life. But let me tell you about the story of because a lot of times people say, well, how did you guys get the name Miccosukee, and what's the other group, Seminole? Who are they? Are they a different tribe? Well, we're all families. We're all, both Miccosukee and Seminole are made up of families that escaped Andrew Jackson's deportation in the 1800s, and we're all families that were under the Creek Federation, and we escaped. Some folks went out to Oklahoma, where they asked the Seminoles. That's why you find Seminoles out there. Although, like I said, that name Seminole was not a Miccosukee or Hidjetit dialect word. It's a Spanish word. So those guys, you go under Seminole, just like the ones here in Fort Lauderdale, which, by the way, the Seminoles that were recognized, a large portion of families that escaped the deportation were recognized around 1958 as the Seminole Tribe of Florida. They put together and then were accepted by the state and federal government, being the first federally and state recognized tribe, as in 1958. And a lot of the people that were left from the wars joined with them because they got dollars and they were able to then eventually go to schools and all that. So it was a lot of families like that, and so they joined or went with the Seminole tribe. Now, I was actually mixed Seminole, considered Seminole on the Bureau of Census until 1962, because we were recognized January 11, 1962. So up until that time, I was on the rolls as a Seminole. And so, but we knew we weren't, but we couldn't do anything about it until it was about in the mid-50s when my father was asked by the medicine people and the tribal leaders to represent them. They had some problems with fishing rights and also cutting of palmetto leaves, so the medicine people asked my father to go to Tallahassee and talk to the government. He was also a good communicator, my dad, Buffalo Tiger. He still is. But he went up there and explained what happened, and I think it was Governor Collins back then said, you know, you're right. You should be entitled to have your food, to be able to hunt, to fish, and have your right to have make your houses out of the palmetto thatch roofs. So that he got through. And then later they tried the Miccosukee. After the Seminole tribe got the recognition, Miccosukee realized they would be lost. They would be just bulldozed over as time went on. if they didn't get federal recognition and get the tribe a piece of land that would last forever held in trust by the federal government.
You tell a great story about how those rights came about. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the Miccosukees decided to try to get federal recognition. They reached out and were turned down, saying, "Well, you guys are part of the Seminoles," and so we said, "No, we're not. We're Miccosukee." And like I said, keep saying that there was never no Indian tribe called Seminole. That was just a given name to these Chimarronis, or these wild people. I don't know how it really came about. But we sought for recognition, turned down. So somehow the Spanish government heard about it. And Fidel Castro, or the Cuban government, heard about that. And they know, they have in the archives of Sevilla, Spain, the records and treaties. They go back to the 1600s. So we got hold of that. We went to Spain, myself and my father. We got a copy of those microfilms, which showed our signature, or whoever was representing me back in the 1600s, signed those documents. So Fidel Castro knew about that, or whoever was in government then, in control of that. So they said to the tribe, "Hey, we know about you guys, and if the government over there doesn't recognize you, come over here. We do. We know we had treaties here, and you can have a piece of land." So he sent a plane. I was about 9 years old, 1959. He sent a plane down to Miami International. I was a little kid. I remember taking my father to the airport and him getting ready for it, and a lot of Indian people getting ready for it, and they'd never traveled before. So about 20 tribal members went down to with their officials, and they laid out the fact that if you can't get recognition, we recognize you. And you can come here and stay, bring your families here. So they offered a piece of land. Meanwhile, the Miami Herald was there, which anybody can go online and find out about this. I think the New York Times was also on board with that mission. And so they were sending dailies back to America, and which went all over. And of course, the government heard. And first the state. Immediately said, "We recognize you. Just come on back." And so to have our land forever held in trust by the federal government. So that was another couple of days that was done. And so the government said, "Look, just come on back. Don't mess with those guys." And so that was a meeting. For the ways to do get where we needed to go. So then the tribe, it took a few years to get our constitution all the way through Congress and all that, and Senate. And so they passed and we went through. So we, with that signing in 1962, that created the two tribes that were families, that were made up of families that escaped Andrew Jackson's deportation that they call the Seminole Wars. When in fact, I don't call it the Seminole Wars. If anything, that would be called some Creek Wars or Miccosukee Wars or something like that. But we were never Seminoles. And even the Seminoles know that. Chief Billy knows that. It's my Miccosukee. So basically, the most Seminoles are from Miccosukee, the same bloodline, and our families, our aunts and uncles and cousins are even over there. And vice versa.
Excellent. Well, listen, let's hear some of your music. Would you like to hear Magic City first, or would you like to hear Red Rocks the Earth?
Red Rocks the Earth. I want to dedicate this also to the Seminole tribe. I was extremely inspired by the acquisition the Seminole tribe made when they purchased the Hard Rock International, which truly made Native American around the earth rock the earth, because they're hard rocks in every country around the globe. So they truly represent the fact that red Roxy Earth, and I wrote this song for that idea of the Seminole Tribe acquisition of purchasing the Hard Rock International globally.
Lowell, let me ask you this before we hear the tune. So you wrote the tune. Did you also arrange it?
I did. I produced, arranged, and wrote it, and I played most of the instruments. I have Rayford Stark on guitar. He plays the slide. And I also have my brother's son, Joey Tiger, on a few of the cuts. So those are two guys that really helped me put it together. But I kind of learned from a friend of mine, Steve Winwood, that was in a group called Traffic many years ago.
Sure.
I learned that a lot of times if you do the actual instrument, nowadays with keyboards, you can just about do everything, that you really can get your own true expression from yourself onto the tracks. Not that that I don't like bands. I do like bands, and I will put a band together, including these guys and other folks, drummers and a drummer and a few other guys, keyboards and a percussionist that will need to be to reproduce the sounds. But yeah, I mainly put this together, and I took from my past the soul music and punk and the Motown sound and the Beatles and Rolling Stones and the Kink and the Yardbirds and all those groups and put them all together that's in my past and came out with that song that you're going to hear.
Okay.
Southern Roots.
So this is Red Rocks the Earth.
Yeah.
Well, that's some hard rocking, man. Far out.
Yeah, I like hard rock. I mean, I was born out of it. And, you know, I like some soft stuff, too. I mean, the other song you'll hear, the Magic City, Miami, you'll hear more melodic stuff, a little lighter, but inspired by just living in Miami, being a part of Miami, being raised in Miami, and, you know, going to school there, having all my friends from there, including you.
Yeah, I really liked it. It has it reminds me of sort of a Phil Spectrum Wall of Sound kind of feel. You
yes,
know?
It is. I told the producer, Steve Gordon, I said, I want that Wall of Sound. In fact,
exactly.
I mentioned the song that he, what was it, You've Lost That Love and Feel?
Sure.
I got
sure.
a ballad on that CD, too, the New Era CD.
Uh-huh.
Which is coming out in February.
Well, that's what I'm going to have you talk about next. But I first want to compliment you again on another aspect of the album or the tune. I thought it was really nice where you've got a nice percussion mix, and then you've got that lead guitar weaving through there, and some very interesting vocals. Very interesting vocals. And like I said, I could hear so many influences. You're a man with a lot of musical experience and very broad musical taste. That's for sure clear.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And my music reflects basically, and in my press releases, you'll probably see that it really reflects the madras, or the weaving of my spirit, my musical career, of all the different influences, and it really peaks out with, and a lot of that peaks out with stuff from the Beatles sound, the hooks,
yeah,
and the Rolling Stones with their funky guitars and the slides and just the bluesy kind of stuff that I really love.
And I also like that talking line in there too.
Oh yeah, that was kind of
your sense of humor showing.
Yeah. Well, that was a little philosophical thing, you know, time is in your mind, because I always think of when somebody asks about, you know, time, is like, well, there's no such thing as time. It was made up by the Swiss or somebody. Well,
sure.
It's clockmakers, well, because we never had time. Time was, you know, so time was really just whenever the clocks came out, so well, real time is in your mind.
Absolutely. That reminds me, there is a place that people can sign up for information about your music. Maybe, did you say download the one of the tunes or a couple tunes?
Yes, we're gonna have that available in about 2 weeks. Where the CD has just been mastered and is now in New York being processed.
Okay.
So, By let's see what they say. I would say by February 15th, we will have that available. If you go to the Tiger Tiger website, it's now it's being worked on. So right now we have it flips over to the simple site, which you click on a link that takes you to what we put up temporarily, and
sure.
On that you'll be able to hear. You can also, we have a CD shop on there, but you can also hear CDs.
So what is the address of that website so that our listeners can go there?
TigerTigerMusic.com.
TigerTigerMusic.com. Super.
And it'll refer you to Simple Sight Lee Tiger, which that when you click on that. Or no, you don't have to click them. Just go to Tiger Tiger Music, and then you click on the link, and it takes you right to the temporary site that we have set up.
Okay, super.
I had to redo the whole Tiger Tiger website because of just all the changes that have gone on, the passing of my brother, and just I had to come up with a whole new era.
Sure, like, sure.
All the new CD, New Era, Tiger Tiger New Era.
Okay, great. So there's going to be a tour to support the album?
Yes, well, we're going to start first here in South Florida with two CD release concerts, and it'll be in Miami and in Fort Lauderdale. I don't have the location as of yet, but we're working on that now.
When those get scheduled, you let me know so we can announce them for you, okay?
Sure will.
Well, definitely. Also, I understand you've been working in public relations and marketing, too.
Yes, over the years, and as I said, my career in music helped me adapt with my father's tribal needs back in the 70s, helped me to reach out and be able to communicate with people on a personal basis. I'm very personal. I don't really go by I don't like phoniness. I'm just myself. I say it like it is, and whatever I believe in, I can sell, because it's not really selling. It's just educating people as to what we have or what I have. And so it came naturally, just like music. When you play music, if you play from your heart, people feel it. If you don't, they don't. So I that's the way I sell. Same way I play music, I sell whatever it is. I communicate, educate, and sell, if you want to call it that, the ideas or the products that we have that are, for example, the Miccosukee Resort or the airboats and the village and the museum that I sold for so many years, and also the Seminole tribe. I work with them with developing their Billy Swamp Safari out in West Broward on 75, and the museum they have. I did work with them over 15 years in development of that, as well as the Hard Rock. I opened. Work with them to open the Hard Rock, my company, Lee Tiger and Associates, which specializes in Native American Indian tourism development, as well as we also, over the years, we've had from the Key West timeframe to the medieval times and other attractions in South Florida.
Well, super. So you have a company called Tiger Enterprise?
It's Lee Tiger and Associates, Inc.,
okay.
And it's been around now for over 25 years. And we started out first right after I'd done a lot of work with Miccosukee. I wanted to kind of reach out and just express myself and also experiment and see how far I could go off the reservation, which I went pretty far with it. I had about 10 accounts that was really a lot of work, and took me... I stayed with that about 10 years or so, with those attractions and doing non-Indian tourism development. They were just regular hotels and attractions in Miami and in Fort Lauderdale and Orlando and in Key West. And then the Seminole tribe asked me to come on and do what I did for Miccosukee out there and on their Big Cypress Reservation, which was the Billy Swamp Safari that we started in. '89, I believe we started that, and it took about 15 years to develop it.
Well, I know way back when you did that, you built that wonderful concert space out there at the Miccosukee location on Tamiami Trail, and you've just grown and grown and grown from there, man. Congratulations on all the fine work that you've done. We're just about wrapping up. Do you want to set up that tune, Magic City?
Yeah, I wanted to mention that song is kind of it really portrays what I've been through as far as growing up in Miami and the Mariel boat thing. And I met Spanish people, and then I've been going down to South America now for the last probably 15, 20 years. And recently, in the last 3 years, I've been going down to Dominican. In fact, I married a Dominican just recently.
Well, congratulations.
In fact, on my CD, I have a song for her, dedicated to her. It's called Bernalice. But the song you're hearing has elements of musical instruments, percussive instruments, that I fused with that song, with acoustic guitars, kind of Beatle hooks, and just all kinds of really cool hooks that make the song really happening. Well, I hope you like it.
Well, thank you so much. Let me fire that up now, and then we'll say goodbye. Thanks again, Lee, so much. Let me get this tune on here.
Magic City, Miami.
With Mr. Lee Tiger. nicely. That's a danceable piece, that's for sure.
Yeah, that'll get people on the dance floor. I hope it makes them happy, too.
Well, you've spent many years on the stage. You know what it takes to get them up there dancing, and I think that you got a hit there, buddy.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. Happy to be here today sharing this stuff with you.
Well, once again, I want to thank Mr. Lee Tiger of the Miccosukee Tribe and the fantastic band Tiger Tiger with this new album coming out. I wish you the best of luck, Lee.
Thank you very much, and good to see you again, and hope to see you real soon. And I'll be back to you with those dates on when we're going to have those release parties.
Please do. People are going to want to know about that. Thanks again, Lee.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, there you have it. You've been listening to the Progressive News Network, and Rick Spivak will be back next Sunday with a new and exciting lineup of guests. So we hope to see you then. In the meantime, all you Florida activists, keep doing what you do, because you do it very well, and you make the world a better place. And that's what it's all about. So good night, and keep trucking. Bye.
There's a better world to come in, tell you why. There's a better world to come in, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come in, tell you why. There's a better world to come in, don't you see. There's a better world to come in, don't you see. When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world a coming, don't you see? There's a better world a coming, and don't you know? There's a better world a coming, don't you know?